Well, hello everyone, you're listening to a podcast on No More Lethal Weight, 10 Steps to Transform Canada's Emergency Departments. And of course, that was the soundtrack from Mission Impossible. What a great set of movies, aren't they? I just love them. At one point, Anthony Hopkins comes out with just a brilliant line. He says to Tom Cruise, Cruise is complaining that their next job was going to be so difficult. And Anthony Hopkins turns and says, "Well, this is Mission Impossible. Difficult should be a walk in the park." And I thought that is so true when we look at emergency medicine. We're trying to do something that seems impossible, and yet it's not. There are tons of things that we can do. We lay out 10 steps in the book, and even though there are 10 steps, it's actually more of a leap. I should say right at the start, I keep saying we. I realize whenever I talk about this book, I say we say this and we say that, because in so many ways, this was a group effort. I mean, the ideas, the concepts came from many, many different leaders. I mean, right at the front of the book, I talk about how Marco Duich and his team down at St. Joe's honed these ideas. But many other leaders shared ideas too. And I would just get in trouble if I started listing names. But I hope when you read this book, you're not going to say, "Oh, this is brand new. I've never heard this before." I mean, if you haven't read in the emergency flow literature or quality literature, maybe you will run across things that you say, "Wow, I've never seen that before." But this book isn't meant to be something radical and new. It's actually just combining some very, very old-fashioned ideas that come from restaurant industry or other on-call services or other staffing approaches, and aligning them together in a way to transform emergency medicine. So this isn't brand new. This isn't a the next best thing or a fad or a silver bullet. In many ways, this is a crisis management approach to an impossibly difficult situation that we find ourselves, especially in Canadian emergency departments. So I thought I'd ask you, why do patients wait? You know, we all have something favorite that we blame, isn't it? Don't we? We blame overcrowded hospitals, the ALC patients, cutbacks, lack of staff, any number of things we can come up with that we think causes waiting. But is it really a surprise that patients wait? How many of you in the Emerge have been asked by your friends or family, "Hey, tell me when's the best time to go to Emerge?" And the crazy thing is that we actually have an answer to it. We say, "Whatever you do, don't show up on a Saturday night or a Monday, or especially not a Monday afternoon, and probably Tuesday's bad too because Monday admits were high." Well, it's the same story all across North America. And yet, if we know that so well, why can't we fix this? Why can't we solve it? And of course, we blame it on the hospital. The hospital's operating on banker's hours and they're not doing a 7-day-a-week operation. But that's not fair. There are many things that we could be doing in the emergency department to change the way the waiting times seem to really blossom or balloon at certain points during the week. So this podcast is going to be going through the introduction of the book and the first step called Revamp Triage. And then I hope to do a number of other podcasts for all the rest of the content in the book too. What I'm most passionate about is that people get a chance to wrestle with the ideas in this book and try to apply them to their own department. The ideas that you hear, I hope you do not see them as a recipe or a silver bullet, but as things that will stimulate your thinking and maybe help you come up with a new approach to something that has been really difficult to change in your department. Anything that you apply to your department has to be sensitive to the context that it's being applied in. So certainly not a cut and paste approach, more of a conceptual approach that we're trying to share with you as opposed to a rigid plan. I would challenge you to set aside or compartmentalize your political responsibility or your system guilt. Not to say that it's not important that we think about the system. Of course, we all agree it is. But to get transformation in the emergency department, we need to start by focusing first on patient service. And when we have a radical devotion to improving patient service, you'll find that cost per case drops. Length of stay and adverse events, they both drop. Quality improves, patient satisfaction improves. In fact, emergency departments function better when we focus on patients first. And I could think that could be an axiom for the whole book. This book promises that if you use this approach, patients will never wait in your waiting room. Patients will all be seen by a physician within an hour. You'll have the shortest possible length of stay and the highest possible quality of care and service. But again, as I said, this is crisis management. A physician leader who I respect, who was chief of our department in not too long ago, said, it's too bad that we have to take this approach, that we have to be this radical. It works. There's no question it works. But it's really a crisis management approach. And for emergency people who work in the emerges, it's something we do all the time, right? We deal with sick people, traumas, resuscitations, things that are crises, and we go in and we manage them. And so this book kind of has the same flavor to it. We're going to be talking about changing flow, but also about operation systems, leadership, and incentives. I don't want to deflect blame for anything that I've said that is wrong, so maybe I should be start saying I, but again, as I said before, this is a group, certainly a group contribution to the content in the book. I divided it into 10 steps to transform Canada's emergency department, and in many ways that's arbitrary. I mean, it's a heuristic or a way of organizing things so that we can dig into each step as we go through, but ultimately this is more of a leap. You know, it's kind of like trying to teach your kids how to jump off a rock or a cliff at the cottage. You say, well, you climb up, you take steps back, then you run forward and you hold your breath and you scream and yell and you hit the water and start paddling. Like we break it up into steps, but really jumping off a cliff into the water is a leap. You do it all at once. And this approach in many ways is a complete package as well. You're better off to try to do everything at once. You can't close your waiting room without addressing staffing ratios inside and furniture and a robust on-call schedule. So there, you can't do one change without trying to change everything else at the same time. Most importantly, we can't wait. We people who work in the emergency departments can't wait for the healthcare system to catch up and change and fix all the problems that we know make our jobs more difficult. But there are still a ton that we can accomplish to improve patient care and patient waiting in our departments that don't require outside help. These are things and decisions that we can make on our own. At the front of the book, I dedicate it to leaders, even those without titles. Many, many people who work in the Emerge will find themselves, for example, in an area where they're trying to do a job and yet their supplies are somewhere else. And they'll say, why is it this way? Why can't I have my supplies where I'm trying to do my work? Those kinds of questions are leadership questions, especially if you take the ideas and start talking with other people about it and maybe talking with the manager of your department or your physician leader or chief or whoever you know that could make change for you. You are acting like a leader. And so this book is for everyone who thinks and questions and works that way. If you're not someone who just comes in and punches a clock and goes home, then this book is for you. This book is also for people who do not work in emergency departments. And I think the concepts that are in these few pages apply to wherever patients have to attend for care. Patients wait in operating rooms, outside the in waiting rooms outside the operating room. They wait in clinics. They wait in private clinics, private offices, outpatient departments. And so the ideas that we discuss in this book apply wherever patients have to wait for care. And I hope you'll find it, I hope you'll agree with me on that. So step one, again, we've divided it into 10 steps. The first step is called revamp triage. And patients go to the emergency department expecting efficient, high-quality care, the right diagnosis, effective treatment, and a great outcome in the shortest possible time. Patients expect triage nurses to assure patient safety by identifying those at risk and moving them rapidly into scarce available care spaces. And this is an impossible task. The Auditor General has shown that it's very difficult to consistently triage people and assign CTAS scores. And we all have our own tales about people who looked okay at triage and then subsequently were found to have something really, really serious later. So the person who looked just a bit drunk and it turned out they had a subdural hematoma, or someone else who seemed to have a sore leg from soccer, but they actually turned out to have necrotizing fasciitis or a sore throat turning out to be acute epiglottitis and requiring a double setup intubation in the ICU. Those are just a few that I've heard, and I know you all probably have similar stories. So we are asking triage nurses to do an impossible job. And when they can't get patients in to receive the care that the patients need, they're sending them out to the waiting room. This is what happens all across Canada, all across North America, in many places. And patients in the waiting room have no chance of getting the care that they need. So triage needs to change. And unfortunately, modern triage has become a specialty unto itself. And in fact, we believe so much that triage is part of emergency medicine that even if patients don't really need anything, we still think that we should give them a good thorough triaging. In fact, even if there are doctors and nurses ready to see patients and beds are open and available, we still insist on triaging patients. Now, there's a example that I write about where we say, you know, what if we had this same approach of triaging, registration, secondary assessment, and all these, you know, the processes that we put patients through. What if that happened at a computer store? And I have to credit Marco Duich for suggesting this as an analogy. And many people actually that have reviewed the book or given me feedback on it say that's one of their favorite parts about the whole book, as they say, yeah, wow, you know, if we went brought our Apple computer into the Apple store on a Monday evening and were forced to endure all sorts of questions that don't seem related at all to why we were there, and then have to listen to technicians tell us that, you know, Mondays are really, really busy and you probably should have brought your computer into your local service technician. You know, we would go berserk, you know, going through the same story over and over, having to sit in hard chairs and then having people say that you're not going to be called in the order that you arrived because there are other people with more serious computer issues. And I mean, the analogy isn't perfect, granted, but the service side of things, we fail when it comes to providing patients with service, starting right at the front door, right up at triage. So history, or we're told when we find out when we read history, and you probably, many of you already know this, that Napoleon's surgeon came up with triage. And his objective was to find the soldiers that he could patch up and send back into battle as quickly as possible. That was his objective in triage. Nowadays, triage has become something different, as I was alluding to. As emergency departments started to run out of money, and the emergency department became a ward, and the waiting room just became an overflow area, we needed something different. And so this whole modern specialty of or specialty training or specialty nursing focus grew around triage. Now, the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians states that triage, in its simplest terms, is about sorting or prioritizing. And if we think back even 25 years ago, even 15 years ago in smaller departments where you could still sleep overnight for a few hours, many places wouldn't have triage nurses sitting out only to see two or three people come in an 8-hour shift. They would work inside the department and help with the load on the inside. And so registration clerks would be sitting out there all night by themselves, and registration clerks would get quite good at saying, that person looks sick. I think they need to go to the acute room right away. And so in some form or another, there has always been an element of sorting or triaging in its most rudimentary sense, long before our modern triage existed. Nowadays, modern triage, as we all know, involves collecting a chief complaint, a CTAS score, and deciding on the best location for them to go to. But it also, we ask triage nurses to get a bit of a history, do their influenza-like illness screening, maybe a focused physical, get their past medical history, do medication reconciliation, and a whole bunch of other things that help us manage an overloaded, lack of space, overcrowded department, but don't really add value to patients. And that's being too kind. I would say they do not add value for patients at all. They add value for us. Ultimately, though, the whole system creates a barrier between patients and the care that they need. And in fact, many of our modern departments now have, at least we used to have, four triage nurses sitting out front, plus a pre-triage screener. So we'd have an experienced senior nurse somewhere out there in the lineup, the hour and a half lineup, just to see the triage nurses going through the line and trying to pick out the sick people who really needed to get into the acute room as quickly as possible. Patients want a diagnosis efficiently, and yet we make them endure all kinds of processes of really questionable benefit. So we need language to talk about flow, about value, efficiency, quality. And so in the book, value is what an informed patient would pay for. Value is health benefit, some sort of addition of health benefit for the patient as they journey through the emergency department. Now, granted, emergency care is often very focused on physical issues, and even though sometimes the psychosocial or psychological or psychiatric issues are the main issue that they're there. But for the most part, we're trying to fix very focused problems. But value is what an informed patient would pay for. And the reason we use those words is you think, I don't know if any of you are experts on smartphones. I'm certainly not an expert on smartphones. And when I need to buy a new smartphone, I go talk to one of my friends who knows a lot about them. And I ask them, you know, do I get a 2-year plan or a 3? Oh, no, you got to get the 2-year plan. They say, don't get the extended warranty, but you really need to do that. And so that kind of person would know exactly what is worth paying for their smartphone. And that's the same thing I have in mind when I'm talking about value and what an informed patient would pay for. And our most informed patients are doctors and nurses who work in emergency departments. And we'll be talking about this a little bit later, how our most privileged patients know how to get around the non-value-added elements in our emergency processes. Flow is the continuous addition of value. And it's not just movement. It's not like Disney, where they have mastered the psychology of waiting. Those of you who have been to Disney World, it's kind of nice. So you're always moving forward. You're always walking. It feels like you're progressing quickly to get onto your ride. But you're not getting value for the time you spend in the lines. They've just figured out a way to make those lines less painful. So flow is not just movement. Flow is the continuous addition of value or something that is benefiting your health or giving you treatment or whatnot while you're in the department. And flow tends to be inhibited primarily by what we do. Whether it's batching or our inefficient work style, or whether we're just overwhelmed, or perhaps we say, you know what, if I go really slow, I won't have to see that really sick or that really old person, CTAS level 3 with belly pain, and get stuck in the middle of a workup right at the end of my shift. Or nurses will do the same. They'll say, gee, if I just stick with my four patients and do a really, really good job with them, I won't have to do more work. So there are all sorts of things that we do that we incorporate into our work patterns that end up slowing down flow. And it leads to one of the axioms in this book, is that low flow or decreased flow causes increased length of stay. That's pretty obvious. But what's often less obvious is that increased length of stay equals increased workload. And it's not just increased workload overall, it's increased workload for every single individual there. Your shift will be much more difficult if there's poor flow, long length of stay. And that jump from the length of stay to the workload, connecting those two, is really a golden area where you can get teams to, you know, your eMERGE team will buy into the idea that we're doing the right thing for patients, we're improving quality, these are all good things. But if you can also add in that idea that this is going to result in less work for all of us, that can usually tip people over and say, yeah, okay, let's try this major change. Whenever you talk about flow, you have to mention speed. Flow does not mean cutting corners or moving really, really fast or providing inadequate care. So it's not about cutting corners. We have to do fast things fast and slow things slow. And sometimes you actually improve flow by spending a little extra time on what you need to get done. But that doesn't mean at the other end of the spectrum about going really slow and doing, you know, in quotations, a really good job of what we're doing. That's not helping anybody. So people who spend, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes educating patients on their diagnosis and where they need to go and what they need to do afterwards, all you're doing there is robbing clinical care time from the next 10 patients who are waiting. So on the one hand, I'm not advocating this book that we cut corners or provide inadequate care, but at the other end of the spectrum, I have a major issue with people who think the emergency department is where you can spend all the time in the world with every single patient. That's just harming the rest of the patients who are also your patients. And one more comment on flow before we leave the topic, and we talk about it more in the book. Many people think that we're going to improve flow by adjusting capacity. So if we just get 10 more beds, or if we get a new ward, if we get twice as large of an emergency department, we'll have better flow. And actually, that's not the case. What ends up happening is that bigger capacity just ends up being filled with patients if you aren't seeing flow as something in and of itself. It's something separate from capacity. Efficiency is just the amount of value that you can add for the resources available. And then quality, the literature usually defines quality with the terms, in terms of effective care, safe, patient-centered, timely care, efficient, equitable care. And so all those qualifiers go into a broader definition of quality. In the emergency department, it's actually much simpler for most of what we do. There's an ISIS document from 2010 that looks at 48 quality indicators for emergency care. When you look at that list, 23 of them are related to time. 16 of them are totally time-based. So time to antibiotics, time to thrombolysis, time to ECG. For emergency care, most of what we do, quality is based on time. No matter how great care you think you're giving, when you finally get to see your patients, if your patients are waiting a long time for triage and a long time in the waiting room and a long time for secondary assessment, no matter how wonderful a job you give when you finally see them, they are not getting high quality care. And so that starts to morph into the next step, which is close your waiting room. But we need to start thinking about triaging patients into the department instead of out. A skilled triage nurse should be able to, in 1 to 2 minutes, decide or collect what the patient's chief complaint is, their CTAS score, and decide on the best location to have that patient receive the care that they need or that the nurse thinks that they need. And so nurses, we should do whatever we can to relentlessly remove all the extra work that we've put onto nurses out at front at triage and get patients as quickly as possible into the department, not out to the waiting room. They're not going to get the care that they need out in the waiting room, and that doesn't add value to patients putting them out there. And really focus on what is the most efficient use of our triage nurse resource and add whatever value we can, really pared down to chief complaint, CTAS, and location. Bottom line, though, is triage should be very quick, sorting chief complaint, CTAS, and sending people off to the best location. So I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. I'll try to answer them in the next blog. The next step we're going to talk about is close your waiting room. And let me know how we can improve this and how we can change it. What's most important to me is that these ideas get out there and they're talked about and they can start transforming our not only emergency care, but our healthcare system in general, wherever patients wait. So thanks again for listening, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.